Good evening. My name is Dick Martin, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dick.
Everybody, but for the grace of God, the actions of AA and sponsorship, I've been sober since September the 15th, 1965, and I'm very grateful for that this evening. It's, first of all, it's a great honor to be asked to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. It isn't something that I take lightly. It's something that I feel is very important. And I feel it's very important because of what I've gotten out of listening to other people speak in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came in September in AA, as I mentioned. And by the way, just for those of you who may be interested, I haven't had a drink since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And for those of you who are new in AA, I want you to know, regardless of what you see around you, you do not have to drink again. You can stay sober. My sponsor just celebrated his 36th anniversary the other day. My friend Francis here on the 21st will have 40 years. And my first sponsor died when he was 33 years sober. And those guys that, in the really traditional sense of the word, 12-step me the first night that I came to my first AA meeting. One of them, as I said, died when he was 33 years sober. Another one was a fellow by the name of Buck Doyle, and he was my sponsor. He became my sponsor. Another was Ernie the attorney. You all may be familiar with Ernie. And another guy was Hugh McGee, and we used to call Hugh No Growth McGee.
Yeah.
And we suspect the reason why he had no growth is because he really never took the steps. But he was a great and a grand guy, and good guy to be with. But he was an interesting man, an interesting guy, and really a man's man and a ladies' man. And he unfortunately sponsored a lot of women from the prone position, but we didn't. We didn't
sobered him up.
He never got him drunk either, so it seemed to work out all right. He was a great 13th stepper, and he wasn't very good, however, at the 14th step, because he never seemed to make amends for what he did in the 13th step, and that's the way that is. But I was taken to my first meeting. I was 12-stepped, and I was taken to my first AA meeting, and it was a service meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at this service meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, the area chairman, who happened to have been Ernie, was explaining the service structure of Alcoholics Anonymous and showed a film strip, something like Circles of Love and Service. And I've been sober ever since. And I want you to take that into consideration. I've often thought about that, and since that time I've 12-stepped a lot of people and taken them to their first meeting, second meeting, and so on and so forth. And I always think to myself, when I take them to the first meeting, I always think to myself, I've got to take them to the right place. I've got to take them where they're going to hear the right message. I've got to take them where they're going to, this guy is speaking tonight, or that gal is speaking tonight, or whatever it happens to be. And, they're going to have the message for them and give them a chance to stay sober. And then I reflect back on what my first meeting was, and I want to tell you, it really doesn't make any difference. And the reason why it doesn't make any difference is because if a person wants to stay sober, they're going to stay sober. If they come to Alcoholics Anonymous and they don't really want to stay sober, they're really not going to stay sober. It takes a desire to stay sober. You have to have a desire to stop drinking. You have to have a desire to stay sober. And if you don't develop that, or if you don't have it or develop that in the first few weeks, the chances of you ever being able to get and grasp onto this new way of life are just remote, remote at best. Probably, according to the conversations I've had with old-timers in AA, and I've had a lot of conversations with a lot of people who have been sober a lot longer than I have, because although I'm sober 29 years, I wasn't always sober 29 years. When I first came into AA, Everybody in the meeting had been sober longer than I had, every one of them. And that was true, really, for quite a few days there, and then one of them had a slip, and I got seniority, which, is, which didn't make me feel bad. But There were some 250,000 people in Alcoholics Anonymous when I first came to AA, and today they estimate there are something like 2.5 million people sober in AA, some nearly 30 years later. And it was AA at that particular time was going through a very strange phenomena. And the phenomena was that the Big Book was unimportant and Bill Wilson was making too much money off of it. And, you know, there are a bunch of derelicts who wrote those stories in the Big Book, and what do they have to do to contribute to our sobriety? And there was a lot of people that were downing the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous for whatever reason they were. And even AA World Services was de-emphasizing the Big Book. And it was one of those eras in AA that you kind of wonder about, and a lot of old-timers down in Texas and Oklahoma got all riled up about it and told them if they didn't shape up, they weren't going to send any more group money to AAWS. And so AAWS listened to it, and then they decided that they would stop doing what they were doing. And so the Big Book has again emerged over the years. But the first book that I was given when I came into AA was Marty Mann's Primer on Alcoholism. And that might sound odd to you, but it wasn't a bad deal to me because I learned something about the disease of alcoholism aside from my own understanding and the understanding that I could get from other people. And I was really very fortunate in a lot of respects because after I'd been in AA a few days, I asked Buck, this guy who 12-stepped me, I asked Buck, I said, these people keep talking about a sponsor. I said, what's a sponsor? And he said, well, I'm a sponsor. I'm your sponsor. And so I never had the opportunity to ask him to sponsor me. He just announced that he was. In today's world, I have these people coming up and say, gee, Dick, could we have a cup of coffee and sit down, or would you like to have lunch, or can I get together with you sometime and chat with you? And I think to myself, you know, now they're going to interview me for sponsorship. And I always say, what for? Because I refuse to be interviewed. I mean, I just absolutely refuse to be interviewed. If who and what I am doesn't speak loudly enough, then I just don't think anybody should be interested in messing with me, that's all. You know, I'm not going to, they want to know if I'm going to be too tough on them, I think. But my sponsor told me on the first night, he said, what I want you to do is, he said, I don't want you to take a drink a day at a time. And he says, that isn't going to be easy. But he said, he asked me, he says, you're not diabetic, are you? And I said, no, I'm not diabetic. And he said, fine, what I want you to do is eat a lot of sweets, because if you eat a lot of sweets, it gives you a physical sense of well-being. And if you have, when you have that desire to have a drink, what you do is you eat something sweet. And he said, in a few minutes, that desire to have a drink will go away. And he said, I want you to eat 3 regular meals a day, and I want you to get some sleep every night. And I want you to, you know, not get too hungry and too angry and too lonely and too tired. And he said, I want you to go to a meeting every night for 6 weeks. I want you to call me every morning. Just as soon as you get in your office, you call me at my office. And he said, if things work out, we'll get together and have lunch during the day. And we did frequently, and I spent a lot of time with my sponsor. And every night we went to a meeting. I would go to a meeting wherever it was that he told me to go, and he was he was always the speaker. I had this strange sort of an idea that maybe there wasn't anybody else speaking in AA except him. As a matter of fact, after 6 weeks, I knew his story as well as he did. You know, I could have gotten up and told it myself, but I'm not going to pull the old saw that I ask him, you know, gee, are you the only speaker in AA? And his answer would have been, well, the only one you need to hear. But that's an old line in AA. But that was kind of his attitude. I mean, to be very honest with you, he kind of felt that he would be able to be the carrier. He would be able to be the channel. He would be able to deliver the message to me so that I could stay sober. And I will tell you this very honestly, and I mean this with every bit of sincerity, every bit of soul and every bit of heart and every bit of mind and every bit of integrity that I have. If it had not been for him, I don't think I would have stayed sober. I really think that he saved my life. I think that he intervened in my life. He came into my life in a period of time that was just right. And he taught me to walk and to live the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for that, you know, for Buck, I will be forever grateful for my life, because that's what he gave to me. And I loved him for that. I mean, he literally saved my life. And I think that that's very important to understand. It's very important to understand that one person can literally be an influence, a great enough influence, to turn us around so that we can change and we can be different and we can, our lives can be enhanced by even just one single person. I'm one of these people that strongly believes that you should only have one sponsor. I don't believe in having several sponsors, because if you have several sponsors, it gives you an opportunity to go out and shop and take the easier, softer way, whichever way that is. And whoever, you know, whichever one of those sick people needs a friend, and they give you a little bit of direction, you end up taking the direction that they give you, and they don't give you anything tough to do because they want to still be your friend. And being an Alcoholics Anonymous is not about making friends. You know, if you're new in AA, and I hope there is someone here new this evening, you will, if you stay in Alcoholics Anonymous, make friends. You'll make great friends. They will be the greatest friends that you've ever had. There are many people out there in the world today, and they say, well, my best friend is Sam or George or Mary or whoever it happens to be. And we don't have a best friend in Alcoholics Anonymous. We really don't. We have rooms full of friends. We have rooms full of best friends. And that is a delight. It is really a delight for me to come to understand that I don't have to have somebody that I have to capture and I have to take hostage, or to be with them alone. I can be with any number of people. And I'm fortunate that I found that out. I found out that really what it amounts to is that there's something wrong with me. And what's wrong with me is that I have a lot of love in me to give away. And I have the capacity to be able to love a lot of people. And I didn't ever know that. I always thought what was wrong with me, I thought the character defect that I had in me was that there was something so bad wrong with me that nobody would love me. And I discovered in Alcoholics Anonymous, after I came here and after I was here for a while, the object is not for someone else to love me at all, but the object is for me to love someone else. And I began by loving my sponsor. And then very gradually I began to love the other guys that he sponsored. And it became kind of a family of sponsorship. You know, he sponsored a lot of people. He was credited with sobering up the whole of Northern Virginia. I don't really think he did that. It was a bit of an exaggeration. But he sponsored a lot of guys, and he was influential in a lot of lives. And so as an end result, there was a lot of people whose lives were touched by lovable old Bucky, and as he called himself. And he looked like a retired Irish cop, and he had no neck, and he was kind of red-faced and on the shorter side, and always walked around with his hands in his coat pockets and ripped his coat open, you know. He was not a dapper man at all, but he was a simple guy, and he loved Alcoholics Anonymous, and he loved the guys that he sponsored, and he loved the gals, and he loved AA, just loved it until he died. And somehow or another that rubbed off on me, because I have the same problem that he does, and I just love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love the guys that I sponsored. And there was a guy the other night who was speaking, and he was saying that he was talking about the gals that his wife sponsored, and he said, I just love them. He said they're my amusement. And I think sometimes that's true, because I sometimes get to talk to Peg's pigeons, and sometimes when she gets exasperated with them, she says, you know, I want you to talk to this one. And okay, and so I do, and we do those sorts of things. We don't share the experiences of the people that we sponsor. I don't share the experiences of the guys that I sponsor with Peggy, nor does she share the experiences of the gals that she sponsors with me, because, frankly, it's none of my business, and it's none of her business. But every now and then, it just every now and then, there's one of them that gets so goofy they become overwhelming to you. I don't know any other way of putting it. And it takes another voice to tell them, you know, for Christ's sake, why don't you suck it up and act like a man? You know, you can't be a man, you can act like a man, you know. And, you know, Peggy had a gal that she sponsored named Sandy. And as a matter of fact, I sponsor her husband yet today. Sandy decided she didn't want to go to meetings. I don't want to go to meetings. I don't like going to meetings. And this was years ago. Sandy's still sober and sober active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She would not answer her telephone, and she'd pull down the blinds. And, you know, she was just a pain in the ass, I think is about the best way of putting it. Peggy said, you know, what I want you to do is I want you to talk to Sandy. And so I had a little conversation with Sandy, and I'm going to tell you exactly what I said. But she was telling me, well, I don't feel like going to meetings. I don't feel like talking to anybody. And I said something about something that she could do with her feelings. And it really didn't make any difference. We didn't care what she felt like. What we wanted her to do was to go to meetings and open her blinds and answer the telephone, because what that was going to do was to save her life. I suggested that she could stuff her feelings somewhere where the sun doesn't shine, is what I told her. Only I said it a little more. I wasn't quite that nice. But she heard what I said, and she had to hear that, and she heard that message. And she's sometimes been a reluctant member of AA since that time, but she's still gone and been active and sponsored gals and been active in AA and goes to her meetings. Still does yet today. And it's a funny word that we hear every now and then. Sometimes the words that we have to give out are not too pretty. Sometimes we're not very nice. Sometimes we have to be very blunt. Sometimes we just don't have time to screw around with some goofy and sit and listen to their long diatribe of nothing, of excuses for not living their life. And so instead of listening to all that, you just tell them, hey, you know, why don't you go down to the group about 7:30? The meeting starts at 8:00. Why don't you go down there about 7:15 and make sure all the tables are clean? I want you to wipe every table off. That's all I want you to do. Well, what's that got to do with my problem? What's that got to do with the way I get along with my wife? It doesn't have anything to do with it, but it gets you out of my hair. And that, just do it. And I was given assignments like that when I came into AA because I think it's our job as sponsors. What we do is kind of amuse the new people until they can take the steps. And I don't know any other better way of putting it. We seem to be able to amuse them long enough until they can take the steps. It's not been my practice to try to explain the steps to the people that I sponsor. The purpose for meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, according to Bill Wilson, is for us to take newcomers so they can be 12-step, so they can learn about the steps. It was my experience that I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard you talk about the steps. I heard if I was in a meeting with 12 people, I had 12 different ideas of what the first step was. And probably, by the way, all 12 of them were probably wrong, but it didn't make any difference. I was able to take a little bit from this one, a little bit from that one, a little bit from this one over here, and so on and so forth, until finally I came up with a feeling about the first step and an understanding of the first step that worked for me. There is not a universal answer to how to work the steps. If there was a universal answer on how to work the steps, then it would be printed somewhere. As closely as I know, it's in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and in the 12 and 12. But even that just discusses it. It really doesn't tell you what to do. It doesn't tell you how to surrender. And I think that what ended up happening to me was that my sponsor superimposed his intellect over my feelings and gave me directions to take that were principled in nature, and as an end result, I surrendered. I don't know any other way of saying it. I just surrendered. And I don't know how I did it. I couldn't do it again. I do it every day, but I mean, I can't tell you how I do it every day. Sometimes it's just, oh, shit, I quit. You know, I just give up. You know, I just give up. You know, I surrender. You know, I quit. You know, I just won't, you know, The hell with it. You know, that's, I mean, and just on and on. I mean, it just seems like, the, you know, some words like that, I just say them over and over again until I think to myself, I wonder what it was that I was surrendering. You know, because most of the time, those things that I surrender are things that are relatively insignificant and unimportant to me in retrospect. At the time, they're very important. But in retrospect, in looking back at them, I think, why do I have so much trouble with that? That doesn't make any sense. You know, it doesn't bother me at all today. It's no temptation, whatever, today at all. And so surrender is one of those things that we have to learn ourselves, and we have to learn how to do it. And without surrender, we're never going to be able to stay sober. I started going to meetings every night, and I started calling my sponsor every morning, and I didn't take a drink a day at a time. I shook a lot. I would wake up in the middle of the night, and my legs would be asleep, my arms would be asleep. And I was beginning to develop at 33 years old when I came into AA, something that they call whiskey legs in those days. They now call it peripheral neuritis, and I give it a little nicer term. But I was a stumbling around drunk is what I was. And I was a relatively young man to be so decimated physically by alcohol, but that's really what happened to me. I was physically decimated by alcohol. And just shortly, as long as that decimation, as that destruction was going on in my life, what ended up happening is that, you know, I began to think that I was crazy. Everybody else began to think I was crazy, too, because they would suggest things like, why don't you do something about your problem, Dick? What do you think my problem is? Well, you have a drinking problem, Dick, because you're perfectly okay when you're not drinking. And I wanted to scream at him. I really wanted to scream at him because I was perfectly okay when I was drinking. It was when I was sober that I was not perfectly okay. I went absolutely nuts when I was sober. I could cover up for a while, but after a while, I just couldn't cover up anymore. It became impossible for me to be able to live with myself because of the pain that I had inflicted on other people and the remorse and the guilt that I had, and it was so strong that I had to drink. And I had to drink because when I drank, I didn't feel that. It just went away. And Buck told me, he said, that's what AA will do for you. It will reduce those feelings of alienation you have with other people to the point where you feel comfortable staying sober. What AA will do is to remove the barriers to sobriety, because you as an alcoholic have a great penchant for drinking, and therefore you're never going to be able to stay sober unless you remove those things that prevent you from staying sober. Not just drinking, but remove those other things in your life that are so difficult that you can't live with. And obviously what those things are those things that we end up writing down on our fourth step. You know, the surrenders that we take and this fourth step that we take and taking a third step. And, you know, I really think that the third step, very simply, and I know that I'm not supposed to be talking about the steps, but you all look like you need a little conversation on that tonight. And I'm not going to go through the 12 steps, so don't get the idea that I am. But the first step, to me, it says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. When it says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, to me that meant I wasn't alone anymore, that I was with other people. I was not this isolated individual, but I was one among many. And I was, because I went to meetings that were as large as this meeting is tonight. The Saturday night Annandale group had 250 people going to it in those days. And, you know, I wasn't alone anymore. I was with other people. And I was given the job of being greeter at the door. And I was a salesman, by the way. That's the way I made my living. And I told Buck, I said, you know, I can't do it anymore. He said, I just can't walk into people. I can't go to cocktail parties. I can't go to social occasions. I can't go to business conferences. And it just scares me to death. I just can't do that. And I always had to drink before I could do that because I didn't have enough self-confidence. And he said, well, when you drank, it took away your self-confidence. And he said, now you don't have any. So what we're going to have to do is redevelop that. You're going to have to develop a better idea about yourself. And one of the ways that you can do is to greet people at the door. And I said, I don't want to greet people at the door. I don't like people. And it's not fair for you to ask me to do that. And he says, I don't care. Just do it anyway. So I did. So every Saturday night, I would greet the people coming into the Annandale group. And I got to know everybody that came in there by their name. And they got to know me. And I would go to other meetings, and they knew who I was. And they'd say, oh, you're Dick. You're the greeter at Annandale on Saturday night. And yeah. So pretty soon, I had a host of friends. And a fellowship grew up around me, as the big book states. It really grew up around me. I was no longer alone. And I always felt very comfortable with the people in AA. I didn't feel like I was less than. I felt like I was equal to, even when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I knew that there were people who had knew a lot more about staying sober than I did. These people had been sober longer than I had. And I respected them, but I didn't feel less than they were. And I think it's necessary for me to understand that today, because I respect people in Alcoholics Anonymous today. I think it's great. There are some people that in AA that I think are, you know, for want of a better word, you know, they're heroes of mine. There are people who have set an example that's exemplary to me enough so that it's been able to be an important thing in my life. But this being powerless over alcohol really meant that I understood what that meant. I couldn't drink safely because I never knew what was going to end up happening to me. So I just couldn't drink safely. I understood that. That made sense to me. But what about this? What about this second sort of this information that comes after a dash? What was that about? And their lives have become unmanageable. My life was unmanageable when I was sober. I couldn't stay sober. I couldn't stay comfortable drinking, and I couldn't stay comfortable not drinking. And that's what it meant to me, and that's what it means to me yet today. And I looked around Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't particularly have a desire to stop drinking. I had a desire to drink when I was an alcoholic, when I was new in AA. And this desire to stop drinking came upon me because I looked around Alcoholics Anonymous, and I took what I know now to be a group conscience. I didn't know what it was then, but I looked around the people around me and saw what they were and saw what they were doing and saw where they had started from and where they were today and what they had become and in their lives. And I began to see these people at meetings over and over again, and I saw them, and we became friendly, and I began to like them. You know, if you become friendly and like people, the next thing that's going to happen is you want to be like they are. And I wanted to be like these people were. And I kind of wondered what it was. What is this? What's the nature of these people? The nature of these people is they were sober. And so I wanted to be sober. So the desire to stay sober came from the other example of the other people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because there's only really two things in AA when you really get down to it. It's the words and the people, and it's the words and the people, and the people are all God's kids, and the words are all God's words. And that's all that's here. There just isn't anything else here. And so once we learn those things and learn very simply that that's the way it is, I decided that I wanted to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never left, but I decided I wanted to go back the next day. I wanted to go to that next meeting, and I wanted to go to that next meeting because there was something there, there was a power there that I didn't have. And what that power was, it was a power to stay sober. And Buck told me, he said, you know, Dick, he said, I know how to do something that you know how to do, and I know how to do something that you don't know how to do. And he says, what I know how to do that you know how to do is I know how to drink. He says, I can drink as good as you. And he was 12 and a half years sober and hadn't had a drink since he came to AA. And he said, but I know how to do something that you don't know how to do. And I know how to stay sober without drinking. And that's what I'm going to teach you. And he said, the first thing I want you to do again was to go to the meetings, not take a drink and call him, and so on and so forth. And I spent a lot of time with him. And he said, what you're going to have to start doing is to do what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it. And you're going to have to be where you say you're going to be when you say you're going to be there. And you're going to have to be there on time. And he says, on time for you is 10 minutes beforehand. And that's AA on time. And I've learned that. You're supposed to be there at 9 o'clock in the morning, be there at 10 of. That's That's on time for an AA member. Because we're kind of reluctant dragons. We're kind of slow and we drag our feet and so on and so forth. And, you know, having, if being on time for work is being there at 10 minutes of 9 as far as we're concerned, then we can get a cup of coffee and sit down and relax a moment before we can get on with work starting at 9 o'clock. And we can be ready and be there and do what we're supposed to do when we're supposed to do it. And he said you have to be willing to do whatever your boss wants you to do. You have to surrender to the fact that they're going to ask you to do some things that you don't want to do. But if you want to keep your job, then you do it. He says, as long as they sign the check on the front and you sign it on the back, you do what they say. Just as simple. Just very simple. He said, by the way, if you don't like your job, go get another one. He said, but don't quit the one you have until you get another one. He said, that's an AA ethic. You never quit the job you have unless you have another one in your pocket. And that saved me a lot of trouble. I wanted to quit a lot of times, various and sundry jobs I had. And I didn't do it because I didn't have another job in hand. But this feeling of sponsorship and guidance and direction and is a very important thing. I think it's important to understand that when I came into AA, I was pretty well whipped. And you are not my sponsor, Peggy. Jesus, she'll never give up. My name is Dick Martin, and I'm an alcoholic. It's quite a trip in Alcoholics Anonymous going along and doing what we're doing. And it's an almost an impossible trip unless we have some guidance. There's no possible way that I can make this trip by myself. And there's no possible way that I want to make this trip by myself. And so having someone around, having a sponsor around who's kind and cheerful and is willing to give me direction, whether it hurts my feelings or not, is a great thing. And I'm glad that I've had someone who has superimposed their intellect over my emotions. Because, see, everything that happens to me, my emotions are involved with it. Everything that I'm going to do, everything that I approach doing, is tinted by my emotions. You know, my own feelings for self-improvement or my own feelings of self-importance or how is this going to make me look? How is that going to make me look? What if I don't do this? And what am I going to lose if I do this? And what am I going to lose if I do that? And what's going to happen? It's going to be too much work, and then I'm not going to be able to do what I really want to do, which is play all the time. And, you know, those sorts of things. And I've learned that I have to spend some time doing some things just straight on. Whether I think that they're right or wrong doesn't make any difference. I just have to do them straight on because they're the principal thing to do. And if I do the principal thing in my life, when I look back, I'm all right. I feel okay with me. And it develops a great sense of humility. It develops a great sense of well-being and a great deal of strength in my own life so I can stand with you and not be ashamed of who and what I am or where I've come from or where I'm going, but to just stand and be with you and to be with my fellow man and not be embarrassed. I don't... There are several stages of sponsorship and what we go through in that. And the first stage is one of being very independent, being very dependent upon our sponsors. You know, we just hang on to every word they have to say and just sit there and our sponsor's speaking and we just sit there and, that's my sponsor. You know, and God knows we've all done that. Then there's one of independence, and that's kind of like a teenager, you know. You end up saying, you know, what does that old fart thinks he knows? You know, I know better than that, for God's sake, you know. And then the next stage that you go through is one of maturity, I believe, and that's one of interdependence, and where we are interdependent with each other. And a lot of people say that, you know, I've been sponsored, I've been sober since, and that's due to both sides of sponsorship, due to those my sponsor and to those people that I have sponsored. And it's really very true. I sponsor 60-some-odd guys actively. And I say actively, they're active in AA, they're going to meetings, and they're sponsoring other people. They have service functions in Alcoholics Anonymous, they're committed to AA. And you might wonder why the hell somebody as sober as long as I have, you know, going to sponsor that number of people, for God's sake. It isn't because I want to. I want to assure you of that. It really isn't because I want to. Sometimes I just as soon drown the whole league of them, to tell you the truth, and get rid of them. But what ends up happening is when they call me and they talk to me about their petty little problems, I don't think about my petty little problems. I must have a lot of petty little problems, the only thing I can tell you, because it keeps me out of myself. And that's the purpose of the whole thing. And I do believe in some fashion that I can be helpful. And I think it's necessary for me to say that. I believe that I can be helpful. If I didn't believe that I could help them, then I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't be willing to take on another case. I've always sponsored a lot of people ever since I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's really saved my bacon. Many, many times it's saved my bacon. And so that both sides of sponsorship, that interdependence that we develop upon each other, is a very important sort of thing. And it's a very close thing. You know, I know things about these guys, and they know things about me that I wouldn't tell my psychiatrist, nor they would tell theirs. You know, I mean, you don't want our psychiatrist to think badly of us, after all, you know. But after I've been sober for some time, Buck and I became friends, which is another thing that can end up happening when you're sponsored by someone. You can end up becoming friends. And when you become friends, when Buck and I became friends, he was no longer an effective sponsor. He was no longer effective because I wouldn't let him be, because we were just friends. And that's all there was to that. And so I came upon a time in my life, I was about 15 years sober, and at this particular time I was sponsoring a lot of guys. I was very active in AA. I was the chairman of the intergroup. I was PI chairman. I was a DCM, state PI chairman. I was a DCM, and I was running the largest AA group between Chicago and Los Angeles. And I was really running Alcoholics Anonymous. I was doing a good job of it, by the way. I have never yet seen anyone do it as good as I did, and I say that with all due modesty, and I mean that. I really did a hell of a job. And there's still people who are screaming about that damn Dick Martin, you know. So I must have made an impression on somebody. There, after I left the Intergroup Association, after I left that, about 5 years later, they started doing all the things that I suggested when I was there. I'm just a man of great vision, man before my time, I guess. And, you know, the same thing happened at the state level. You know, I think that we should have all of the committees that they have in the service manual. And they said, well, you know, we're not ready for that yet. And I said, the hell we're not. And I pushed it through. And there was a lot of other young guys like I was who had a lot of energy and a lot of fight and spit. And we decided we were going to do it regardless of what they said. And they did push them through. And some of them are even active today. And some of those committees are now doing a thoroughly good job, and some of them aren't, but you know, that's the way that is. But I was very pleased that when I stood for delegate and the first time and I didn't make it, and I was pleased that I didn't make it because I'd only been there and for a short period of time, so I was not well recognized, but I knew 2 years later without a doubt I'd be swept in. And instead of that, they really rallied together. The people in the western part of the state, they rallied together and collected newcomers to come in to vote against me. And they were literally told, we don't care who you vote for, just don't vote for Dick Martin. And I didn't find that out until a little bit later, but it's not easy being a minority voice. But regardless of that, I've always been a very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I began to feel that I needed some discipline in my life because I was becoming beginning to become a kind of a, well, I wasn't proud of the kind of an AA member I was. I don't know any other way of putting it. I would go to AA meetings, and I wouldn't clean up before I went to a meeting necessarily, and I was just too casual about the whole thing. I acted too casually about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I decided that I better change my act, because if I didn't, I was going to become bored with AA. And I didn't want to become bored with AA. And there were two men that I thought about having to sponsor me. And both of them are still sober in AA today. And both of them are still grand guys. One of them was a very fine gentleman who at that time had been sober for about 40 years. No, he'd been sober about 30 years, I guess, because he's been sober 44 years now, I believe it is. And but I really did and still yet do today respect him a great deal, and I thought very seriously of asking him to sponsor me. And I was asked to speak out in Sacramento, California, and so I decided what I would do is I would go down and visit my friend Clancy down to Midnight Mission in Los Angeles and go to the Pacific Group on the way back. I had some extra time on my hands. And I was dancing back and forth between asking Clancy maybe to sponsor me and then asking this other guy to sponsor me. And you might think that, you know, that's kind of strange. I live in Bellevue, Nebraska, and Omaha's our largest suburb. We're not a really very big community. We're only a town of some 40,000 people. And, you know, I thought to myself, what are my friends going to say? That, you know, you have to have some big name speaker, some big time AA to be your sponsor, and you know, you can't just take the guy locally. There wasn't an AA member in the Omaha area who was sober longer than I was, who was active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's why. It's really very simple. And when you reach a point like that, you got to do something. And so I had to do what I did. And so I had to reach out beyond that. Clancy and I had been friends for years. And I was on my way down to Los Angeles in the plane, and I thought to myself, if I ask Clancy to sponsor me, he's going to ask me to shave my mustache off, because he doesn't sponsor people who have facial hair. And I thought to myself, well, that's all right. If he wants me to shave my mustache off, I'll shave my mustache off. If he wants me to shave my head, I'll shave my head. I'll do whatever he asks me to do. And what I did was I surrendered again. I surrendered to the principle of sponsorship. I told myself that I was willing to do anything that he asked me to do, period. And so I walked in and talked to him in his office, and I said, Clancy, these are the circumstances, and I would like you to please sponsor me. And he said, I will, Dick, but I am no longer your friend. And I said, the hell you're not. And he is a friend, but not a friend. He's always a sponsor first. And he and I have a great relationship. I can't possibly tell you that he has ever jumped all over me and given me hell and given me a bad time, because he never has. He is really the most loving, gentle man that I've ever met in my life. And I know that might be hard for you to see, but it's not hard for me to see. And he's always been extremely kind and loving and caring to me, and I wouldn't expect it to be any other way. When I was 20 years sober, I called Clancy to thank him for his participating in my life, as I always do. Call my sponsor and thank him. And he says, well, how does it feel to be sober for 20 years, Dick? And I said, I feel like I'm getting ready to join a minority group in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, what's that? And I said, old-timers who are still active in AA. And he says, what do you mean, old-timers? And I said, well, I always thought when you became 20 years sober, you became an old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, no, that's not true. And I said, wait a minute. I said, I remember you talking when you were 19 years sober, and you said, you know, this Halloween when I'm sober for 20 years and become an old-timer, things are going to be different in my life. And he says, yeah, he says, that's what I thought then. But he says, I've been sober for 27 years now. And he says, I think you've become an old-timer at 25. I was sober for 25 years, and I called Clancy. And thanked him for participating in my life and didn't say a damn thing about it. Because, frankly, I'd just as soon be a newcomer in AA and still do the things I used to do. I still go and I help set up chairs and I tear down chairs and I help with coffee and I do those things in AA that I did when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it keeps me new in AA and it keeps me interested in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not running Alcoholics Anonymous anymore. I don't try to do that. I have some service jobs which are rather ignominious. I check the men's room and the women's room and the meeting on Tuesday night to make sure they're clean before I go home. And that's a hell of a service job. The women's room is always messy. I want you to know that. I swear. But a couple of years ago, I got very ill and I was hospitalized. And while I was in the hospital, I had my own morphine pump for about 5 days. So it'll give you some idea. I had an aortal resection bypass. And I got a call from my sponsor every day. And he called and said, how are you doing? I love you. Take care of yourself. And that was all the conversation. But he gave me a poor fellow once, and that's all the sympathy I ever got, I can tell you that. About 6 months prior to that, I was having a little difficulty. And I woke up one night about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I thought to myself, I wonder how I'm going to commit suicide, and so it will harm those people the least around me. And I thought, my God, what's the matter with you that you would even think of doing something like that? That doesn't make any sense, because I hadn't thought about committing suicide for a long time. Homicide I thought of several times, but I'd never thought about committing suicide. I mean, I just since I've been sober, that has not been my style. And next, I went back to sleep, and I got up the next morning. I called Clancy, and I told him what went on. And he said, Dick, he said, how old are you? And I said, I'm 60. And he says, huh. He said, well, let me tell you something. He said, when were you 60? And I said, last December. And he says, uh-huh, as if that was significant. And he said, let me tell you something. The age of 50 is the watershed year for women. And he said, the age of 60 is the watershed year for men. He says, at that age, they think it's all over. And he says, Dick, I don't want you to think it's all over, but it is. And I swear to God, I haven't felt sorry for myself since. Our sponsors teach us to laugh at ourselves so that we don't take ourselves so damn seriously. You know, it's really... You know, Rule 62 is a very, very important rule, and that rule came about. Bill was some club had sent him a sheet of paper listing all the rules that they had for membership on Alcoholics Anonymous at that particular club. Bill wrote back and he said, "You forgot about Rule 62," and he says, "That's don't take yourself so damn seriously." And we take sobriety very seriously, but we don't take ourselves very seriously because we're going to change at the opening of a door. You know, my feelings change when she walks by or when she walks by, whichever the case may be. And, you know, that's the way it is. Our feelings change, but we can appear to be normal by acting better than we feel. And those are some of the many things that I've been taught since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I couldn't have lived. I could not have lived without sponsorship. And if you don't have a sponsor, I would strongly suggest that you get one now. Don't wait, because it's your life. Thank you.